Hi, welcome to the Top 100 Project with Ryan and Bev Ellis. If you're a new listener, we invite you to check out our introductory podcast, our prequel episode, if you will, where we talk about our project analyzing the American Film Institute and their 1998 and 2007 lists of the greatest American films ever made. Warning, there are spoilers ahead. This podcast is meant to be listened to after you've seen the film.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Okay, listeners, it's a Top 100 Project movie, number 18, and it's Bringing Up Baby, which squeaked onto the 1998 AFI Top 100 in 97th spot, but leapfrogged its way into 88th spot in 2007. It was between Westerns Unforgiven and The Searchers in 1998, then betwixt two brand new additions, Do the Right Thing and Blade Runner, in 2007. Bringing Up Baby was released by RKO on February 18, 1938. The movie wasn't the notorious flop it's reputed to be. It actually broke even at the box office and made a profit after being re-released in the years that followed. That didn't stop theater owners from calling Katharine Hepburn box office poison. And the movie in a nutshell I came up with for this one, Bev, is it's the story of a man's bone and a woman's pussy cat. But to more thoroughly explain the plot, here's Bev with the skinny.
While trying to secure a $1 million donation for his museum, David, an easily flustered paleontologist played by Cary Grant, is harangued and followed by a confident and madcap heiress named Susan, played by Katharine Hepburn. Susan falls for David right off the bat, but David does not fall in return. Also, Susan's docile pet leopard baby is along for the wacky ride, as are other goofy sidekicks and interlopers.
And speaking of other goofy sidekicks and interlopers, you will probably hear Fox yet again on this podcast bringing up Foxy, panting and whining and moaning as he likes to do, our little dog Fox.
It's a very hot day, so you're probably going to hear him panting in the background.
You might hear us panting because the air conditioning is off so we can record this thing. Ooh, it's already hot. Okay, so Bringing Up Baby, Grant, Hepburn, Howard Hawks, director. What do you think?
It was great. It's a really fun, funny movie. It cracked me up. Hepburn and Grant are just incredible together. They have such a great chemistry. They're so much fun. I always love her, and I can't say I've honestly seen a lot of Cary Grant before we started this project, but I'm definitely becoming a fan.
You saw North by Northwest. Now, that won't come up for many years, I guess, in the project, but you saw that last year, right?
Yes.
And did you like it?
I liked it, although I recall complaining at the time that he is really just god-awful at playing drunk.
Yeah, in that one scene.
Yeah.
Okay, but back to Bringing Up Baby.
It was really fun. I really enjoyed it. I kind of question maybe the validity of it being on the list only because it's hard to give it credit for being very influential. It's not.
Yeah.
It was a popular genre at the time, and sure, it very well may be one of the best, but if you're just going to be a good, funny movie, it's a great funny movie. I don't know how I'm going to finish that thought. Let's put it that way.
I like Bring It Baby. I'm not a huge fan. As far as it being AFI worthy, I would say yes because of one key thing, and that gets Howard Hawks on this list. Otherwise, he wouldn't be on at all. But I'm not a huge fan. When I saw it the first time, and I only saw it in 98, as I've said many times already in this project, because it was an AFI film. And I'd never even heard of it when the first list came out. And I was not hugely enamored. I didn't like Cary Grant that much, actually, when I first saw him. I've certainly grown to like him a lot more since. He's really grown on me.
Mm-hmm.
And Hepburn is very good, but she was new to doing this kind of comedy. She'd done a few comedies before, but anything close to this. And she struggled with it a little bit at first. One of her co-stars, Walter Catlett, he really helped Hepburn a lot with making her role work. And I don't think you can see any point in the movie where it's not working, where she's not doing a good job.
No,
but it's just, it wasn't her natural thing to do, I guess is the best way of putting it.
I read that what he taught her was, instead of overdoing everything, to play it seriously. Like, comedy is a commitment. The audience has to believe that the character really means it. Not that they're joking, that they're trying to be silly. It's so much funnier when you think they're just genuinely trying to, you know, tame a leopard. And that he got cast in that movie because Hepburn insisted, after all the coaching she received from him, insisted that he get a part in the movie, and then he was cast as the constable?
Constable Slocum, I believe that is, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's funny because his role is one that maybe could have been one of the more serious ones, but he's also zany like everybody in the movie is. And one point we'll get into when we get more into Hawks later is that Hawks learned from this movie, the mistake of it was that everybody is goofy and you have to have a straight man. And with His Girl Friday, a couple years later, Ralph Bellamy plays the straight man. And there's not really a straight man in this movie. I think maybe the constable was the best choice for that. The closest to a straight man is probably Cary Grant, but even he's
not. Yeah, Cary Grant is kind of... He gets driven crazy by everything that's going on around him. But he's kind of like a normal guy at the beginning. A normal guy that for some reason... Once again, another movie where a couple about to be married fails to discuss...
Well, Alice wanted no domestic entanglements. What a dream woman! She's implying they don't have to worry about having kids, and he's so... caught up in his work in the museum and all that, that's probably great for him.
Why did they wait until the night before their wedding to have that conversation? Because in front of a colleague,
no less. The cameras weren't rolling at that point, that's why.
What? You don't want to have children? They also discussed the night before their wedding whether or not they would have a honeymoon. These people do not plan ahead.
As recent married people, we discussed all these things long before the night before.
Yeah, yeah.
We talked about it. It was like we got married May the 10th. It was, I don't know, May the 1st at least.
So, how many children do you want, dear?
Okay, well, this is the second screwball comedy on the list so far after It Happened One Night. And we have a couple more coming up pretty soon, The Philadelphia Story with Grant and Hepburn again. Mm-hmm. Different director that time. Let's talk about Cary Grant and Katharine Hepburn more specifically. Grant was in Topper and The Awful Truth in 1937. The Awful Truth is one of my, I would say, favorite early rom-coms. He's with Irene Dunne in that one. And he'd also done Holiday with Hepburn later in 1938, the same year as Bringing Up Baby. And by that point, Grant had perfected the art of the male comic performance. And as we said, Hepburn hadn't perfected what she was going to be better at as she went along. She did a lot of comedies, mm-hmm. a lot of them with Spencer Tracy. I think there's only one movie that they made together on the list, and that's Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. But Grant worked with Hepburn four times in total, and he worked with Hawks a lot of times. Mm-hmm. I didn't even bother counting. I know it's a ton. And Hawks actually didn't even want Cary Grant in the first place. It wasn't like he was against the idea, but he initially wanted Harold Lloyd, a silent screen star who was sort of the third of the Buster Keaton, Charlie Chaplin group. People don't usually talk about Harold Lloyd at all the same way as they mm-hmm. do with Chaplin and Keaton. But he was very good. And Grant has a Lloyd quality with the way he does things in this film. He even wears Lloyd-esque glasses. Which I know means nothing to you. You've not seen a Lloyd movie, but
yeah, this is yet another movie where the lead actor, you know, really didn't want to appear in the movie, was coerced into it, and then it wound up being, you know, a classic romantic comedy.
Because the other one so far on the list, It Happened One Night, Clark Gable didn't want to do it.
Yeah, but in the end, the movies became classics.
Yeah, but they also were smart to base this somewhat in reality. It's been said, mm-hmm. base it somewhat in reality. Because people say that the Susan-David relationship was partly based on a real-life love affair between Hepburn and mm-hmm. director John Ford.
Yeah.
A little bit more about the box office poison label that people gave to Hepburn. It was theater owners that said that. Mm-hmm. I guess they have something to base that on. People must not have been going to these movies. Although, as I said, Bringing Up Baby was not a dud or a bomb.
She had had a few bombs in a row prior. And she was getting a pretty bad reputation in the public. She wasn't very cooperative with press, and she wasn't very cooperative with fans.
She was notorious for that, actually.
Yeah, which, you know, made her pretty unpopular with the public. So that could be part of the reason why the film didn't do well. I read somewhere that a critic did just flat out blame her. The public didn't want to see a Hepburn movie because they didn't like her. Mm.
Well, many people have been granted that label officially or unofficially ever since this movie. And there's probably better evidence that, say, the Ben Afflecks of the world, for a while, mm-hmm. he was anathema to people wanting to go see his movies. Mm-hmm. And it was the J-Lo phase back in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
And other people have been called poison, too. And it's almost always that if you've got real talent, you'll bounce back from that and you may even become bigger than ever. Look at Affleck, for example, mm-hmm. an Academy Award winning, well, for producing, but still an Academy Award winning director of Argo.
Slate.com actually recently ran this vintage article about Hepburn, and knowing that we were going to watch the movie, I read it. It's about how 2 years later, when her career kind of recovered with Philadelphia Story, which has mm-hmm. a very interesting story behind how it got made and what it had to do with her and her comeback. Stay tuned for that podcast a couple of months from now.
Nice plug.
She gives great plug.
Today's new sponsor, The Plug. Brought to you by Bev.
Our sponsor is the Top 100 Project podcast.
We're sponsoring ourselves.
The Top 100 Project is brought to you by the Top 100 Project.
What's that? That snake that eats itself? The Erebus? Continue.
So the Vintage article that I found, it was in kind of like a gossip mag, and they talked about how Hepburn's comeback meant that obviously she had benefited from the spanking she had received from Hollywood, that she, you know, had been humbled, and this comeback was all about her, you know, coming back to the public, a new woman who was going to behave this time around. It was a very 30s, very interesting.
And she was a notorious women's lib type person even before that was a phrase of any kind.
Yeah. And
very independent thinker.
Yeah. And she, yeah, she wore pants and she kind of dated casually and had a very confident air, some might say a masculine way about her.
And she went on to become probably the most honored and revered woman in movie history based on Academy Award nominations and wins of Academy Awards. Mm-hmm. And just kind of her general popularity with the public at this point, I think.
It's part of her appeal with me that she, you know, went against the grain and she didn't kiss ass with the press, that she was herself and wasn't one of those kind of delicate starlets. That is part of her appeal. And it proves that women like that are appealing back then and certainly now.
Even though she was difficult to work with, this is almost the anti-Marilyn Monroe argument.
Well, you know, we always talk about how studios will sabotage stars' careers. And when you read about the production of this movie, you could very well guess that the studio may have wanted to sabotage her career. She was a pain in the butt. She made the film fall behind schedule. She wasn't, like we said, she wasn't very cooperative with the press. It's possible, like, when she bought out her contract, maybe they were just desperate to ditch her. Maybe they helped exaggerate that she was box office poison. Maybe they were trying to get rid of her the way they did with Buster Keaton and
James Whale.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she was such a pain in the buttocks on set that the production went over budget and over schedule.
Yeah, not that she was the only one to blame.
Of course not.
Hawks himself blamed her along with the animal actors, but said that because she needed all the coaching, so scenes that they shot initially had to be redone. Her and Grant would ad-lib and frequently ruin scenes by cracking each other up. And then the film also went over budget because her and the rest of the cast, they all had overtime clauses in their contracts, which meant that because the film went 40 days over schedule, they got paid way more money than the budget allotted.
The Marlon Brando contract.
Is that right?
Well, people say that Brando delayed so much in Apocalypse Now. He finally confessed to Francis Ford Coppola on the set that he hadn't read the book, he hadn't read the script, he wasn't prepared at all. And of course, he was massively overweight, which is not supposed to be what he was going to be. He would get back in shape because he's playing an army colonel. And some have said he did it on purpose so he could make a lot more money because they went way over overtime.
Well, when you hear stories like that, it's kind of like, what would motivate them to step on it and to get the film done on time? It's
professionalism.
You know, if a star doesn't have professionalism, then it is kind of their fault if it makes them unpopular. It doesn't make, when I hear stories like that about actors acting like jackasses, it certainly doesn't make me like them more. It doesn't make me want to go spend money to see their movies in the theater. This stuff actually matters. Public image matters in that respect.
For sure. Well, we've talked a lot about Hepburn and Grant. Let's talk a little bit about the supporting cast. Not huge names, but interesting, kind of funny, real names, I would say. Charles Ruggles is in this movie. Barry Fitzgerald, who would win an Oscar for the ooey gooey Going My Way in 1944. He plays a priest or something in that, I forget. But he's in this, and he was a good character actor. He worked with John Ford quite a bit, I believe. And then the fine character actress Mae Robson was Aunt Elizabeth.
Mm-hmm.
And then we mentioned Walter Catlett already, and they did a fine job.
And I think you're forgetting the two most important members of the supporting cast.
Who would they be?
The leopard Nyssa, the incredible leopard Nyssa, and probably the biggest star of the movie before it came out, the dog that played Asta, who was George in this movie, apparently was a huge celebrity for appearing in all the Thin Man movies. And I have to give this movie credit for containing the most harrowing, suspenseful scene I have yet to see in any of these movies, and that is the scene where the dog and the leopard are play fighting. I was so scared the dog was going to die. It was the most upsetting thing I've seen. And all I think was like the low standards they had back then for the humane treatment of animals on set.
Anyway.
Well, I have a feeling that this leopard was probably pretty well treated. It's really impressive.
Yeah, it was a real leopard too. They actually did a lot of things with split screens and moving mats to with the leopard so they could be in the scenes with the actors. And Cary Grant was terrified of the thing. But Hepburn wasn't, and Hepburn interacted with it almost like, come here, leopard, let's go play over at the jungle gym.
That's why she's awesome.
And there was a trainer on set all the time, of course, probably within inches of the edge of the camera. But I didn't read about any kind of real problems with the thing. It didn't
attack
anybody.
There's like one story about how she had to crack the whip because Hepburn's dress freaked the leopard out briefly, but that's all it took. And then she behaved herself.
One thing we don't do on these podcasts too often is just spend 15 minutes going over, and then I like that scene, and then I like that scene too. But we will do it for a minute because we probably won't otherwise talk about the infamous scene in the movie Speaking of Dresses when hers gets ripped at the ball and then Grant's coat gets ripped at the ball. And all. That's one of the more famous and funny scenes from this movie.
And what I think part of what really makes it work is like up until that point, she's been very haughty and she's always had the upper hand. And that's the moment that he finally gets the upper hand. And it's like the cute back and forth of him trying to convince her that she needs his help, and you know, the scene that of course would have been over in 10 seconds if he just could have spit out what the problem was, but so much more fun to watch her walk around with like her underwear showing.
And for a scene that is 1938 with the code and everything, production code, was kind of sexual, him walking right behind her, his crotch right in her
it almost butt. Got cut too, that with apparently the production code did have a problem with that. But they managed to keep it in somehow.
And one more supporting cast member would be Ward Bond. This was the second of, I think it's 7 movies that he did that were on the AFI. Here he played a motorcycle cop. He was the, guy in Apple Night on the Bus. And we're going to see a lot of Ward Bond in the next, 15 or 20 years worth of movies.
He was never a movie star, but he sure had a good agent that had good taste in scripts. Or great luck.
He could have been in Stagecoach, I was reading. Again, we're getting ahead of ourselves. I don't think he is because he couldn't ride the coach. He was going to be the one that actually is in charge of the coach.
How about that? Yeah. It could have been 8.
I hope I'm right that he wasn't in the movie, or else I will be wrong before we even get to that movie.
Before we move away from talking about the cast, this is more of a character thing, but I did want to point out, I'm sure people might disagree with me, but Hepburn's character Susan, to me, she kind of reminded me of the manic pixie dream girl trope. She was, you know, a little bit immature and flighty, and she didn't seem to have much purpose in life outside of chasing this man. I'm sure people could disagree with me. I always find that the manic pixie dream girl trope, well, I totally believe it exists. Its definition is always like a little bit vague to me, and people seem to have these kind of inane arguments about who is and isn't a manic pixie dream girl. But to me, she just kind of, she fit the mold a little bit. Maybe she's, you know, an early archetype for the manic pixie.
Didn't have the looks I would think you'd usually see with that.
She's not very childish looking, but she's kind of childish acting. She's certainly very...
Well, she falls in love with him instantly, which is not uncommon for movies of that
age. And she's just, like, clumsy and spontaneous and foolish. She does crazy, stupid, reckless things pretty persistently throughout the movie, and she gets this kind of, he's not depressed or solemn, but he's certainly kind of serious and in his head, and she brings him out of his shell.
Unlike Alice, who is very reserved.
Yes.
She's the not so appealing, because she's too appealing almost. She's not bizarre.
She's too much like him.
He needs that. Okay, so the screenwriters, who definitely have to get credit for this because we're getting into a little more famous names now as we get along on the project. The writer of the screenplay was Dudley Nichols, a frequent collaborator with John Ford. In fact, Nichols wrote our next movie, I'll say it again, Stagecoach, for John Ford.
Our sponsor today, Stagecoach.
Our second sponsor. We had one already with our own podcast. Now it's a movie that's from 1939.
It was based on a short story by Hagar Wild, who also contributed to the writing of the script. And a cute little note, especially because it's a romantic film. The two fell in love. While they were working together to write the script.
Very touching.
Yeah, I thought that was cute.
Well, we will talk for the only time, unless we refer back to this movie later on, about one of the great directors of the business, Howard Hawks. This is the only time we're going to do it officially because he didn't have any other AFI movies out of the 123. You've never seen a Hawks film, I'm assuming, before this. You've now seen 2. We're going to talk about the other one very soon. Mm-hmm. But he also directed Only Angels Have Wings the year after this, His Girl Friday the year after that, The Big Sleep in the mid-40s, Red River a couple years after that, and then Rio Bravo, which is one of Quentin Tarantino's very favorite movies. Tarantino is a huge Hawks fan, incidentally. And all of those, except for Rio Bravo, were nominated for the original AFI list. And Hawks was a director who was known for overlapping dialogue, his versatility, because he could do comedies and he could do dramas and he could do westerns. I think his two best genres were comedies and westerns. And he got the best work of John Wayne's career up to that point in 1948 with Red River. John Ford, who'd worked with Wayne a lot by that point, said, I didn't know the Big Monkey could act. and it was Hawks that directed him in that film, who also worked with Montgomery Clift, who is so different than Wayne in every way, including politically, as a, like, beyond filmmaking, that they didn't agree with politics. But apparently the two of them got along okay, because they said, let's not discuss politics. But here's a guy who has to direct those two types of actors, somebody of the new breed that Clift was bringing in with the Actor Studio type stuff, and Wayne, who'd been working since the early 20s in silent movies, just a whole, and that manly man thing. Clift was notoriously bisexual, and Hawks managed to shepherd them through.
I think we said when we were talking about the movie that Hawks is like one of those Hollywood workhorses that isn't as recognizable a name as a lot of the other directors whose films made the list. But when you look at his resume of films, it's a lot of really well-liked movies, and none of them were total duds in the box office or critically. He was just good at making good movies.
Yeah, he really was. I mean, the list I had mentioned a few minutes ago, most directors, if they had three of those, they'd be happy. And he had those, plus Bringing It Baby, plus other ones that didn't include Ball of Fire with Barbara Stanwyck, who was a great actress, is another good one. So he's got a tremendous list. And he learned on this movie that you have to have at least one normal person in the screwball comedy. And His Girl Friday, as we said, has more of that. And maybe that's why that one worked. And that's what I want to get into next, is the His Girl Friday, Bringing It Baby comparisons. Now, why are they being compared? Because a few days ago, you and I got talking about these two movies. And I said, I bet the AFI likes His Girl Friday more, without knowing for sure. Meaning, it was on more lists and it was maybe more recognized in other ways with awards
you,
and things.
Yeah, you were just 100% convinced that... Mm-hmm. There was almost as if a mistake has been made, and His Girl Friday is clearly a better movie. It's clearly a more well-liked movie.
But here it is. His Girl Friday was 19th on the top 100 laughs list, the top 100 funnies. Bring It Baby was 14th. His Girl Friday was not on the top 100 passions, and Bring It Baby was 51st. His Girl Friday didn't make either top 100 list, but Bring It Baby was on both, 97th and then 88th. And neither one of them won an Oscar. They both are 8.0. About 30,000 people have voted for the IMDb's top list, as you can see on the website.
Yeah, they're square. They're perfectly tied on IMDb.
So my theory doesn't hold water, but I just thought it was true. I personally prefer His Girl Friday. I wish it had made the list. I wish that when they re-voted that they'd not necessarily knock Bring Up Baby off, but they'd at least got His Girl Friday on, because it's a movie that I will probably watch more as I get older and want to see an old comedy. Be like, there's about four or five I'd want to see, and that's definitely one of them. But this isn't.
Really? See, yeah. I'm the other way around, where I totally enjoy His Girl Friday, but I feel like it's just more likely I would watch Bringing Up Baby again.
As part of our project, Bev actually watched His Girl Friday a couple days after we saw Bringing Up Baby, just because she wanted to see the comparison and see.
Well, I certainly can't call it a chore. It was a positively delightful movie.
But you did your homework
anyway. And I recommend that too. I do it for you. I do it for the listeners. You're welcome. It was a really good movie, and I really enjoyed it, and I can see how it's a close call, but I think Bringing Up Baby is just a slightly more fun movie. I laughed harder at Bringing Up Baby, and I found the kind of the plot of His Girl Friday with the cop killer and the woman who jumps out a window, it was just slightly too dour to keep the comedy pace going. It was hard to laugh at a movie that also had these like truly sad elements to it. Okay. And sometimes I've seen movies that make that work really well, but I think I personally struggle with that more than some people do. And what can I say? I just like Bringing Up Baby more. Maybe it's because I love animals so much.
And there are two great ones in this film.
Yeah.
Well, how about the influence of Bringing Up Baby? Remade by Hawks enthusiast Peter Bogdanovich with Barbara Streisand and Ryan O'Neal in What's Up, Doc? And it actually influenced Hawks' own comedies, especially, as we just said, His Girl Friday. And then the overlapping dialogue became a specialty of Hawks, maybe not from this point forward, but certainly this was one of the ones that probably convinced him he could keep doing it. And then Robert Altman is maybe the best user of that technique of filmmaking that's ever existed.
Oh, yeah.
Altman, and not just him, technicians, of course, came up with the system with microphones and how to make the audio work by having everybody be mic'd in a scene. And we're talking 15 or 20 people sometimes in his movies. Hawks didn't have that advantage back in those days.
While we're talking about Hawks' influence on other directors, I found this great quote that he told Peter Bogdanovich. And this kind of is reflected in Hawks' style, and it's kind of an aspect of the style that I appreciate, and you and I have talked about before, and that is that he said to him, you get more pace if you pace the actors quickly within the frame rather than cross-cutting fast. And you and I always say, you know, it's better to have something great happening in front of a still camera shot than have the camera trying to do all the work for you.
I concur. The other thing that Hawks used in this film, I should say didn't use in this film, that is such a crutch in so many movies of that era and absolutely in the modern era, there's no music.
Yeah.
Except for the opening and closing credits.
And the singing. True Frankenstein. When they sing to the leper.
Yeah, okay, right. But that's, you'd call that diegetic music. Yes. Because it's within the scene. But he didn't rely on a lot of zany score.
Yeah. Another thing that I like.
Okay, well, I've already said all these, but I'm going to quickly go over the awards and other AFI lists for Bring Up Baby. So it was 14th on the Top 100 Laughs, 51st on the Top 100 Passions, and it was a film that's being preserved by Congress in the National Film Registry, and they put that in there in 1990, 1 year into the project for them. All right, so last thoughts, Bring Up Baby.
I still don't know if it belongs on the list. I'm not exactly sure how I feel about that, but I would still really enthusiastically recommend it to anybody. You don't have to be primed to like old movies to enjoy.
Well, this is the kind of movie, even though I wouldn't have said to you, you gotta see Bring Up Baby if we hadn't done the project and you just wanted to see these old films. But this is the kind of thing I was talking about when we mentioned the infamous hard vegetable soup with the old silent films, the 3-hour epics by Griffith. You know, let's get through that stuff. Let's do our homework with those. And then we're going to get to have more fun, even with movies that may not be that great and may not be that important in comparison to Birth of a Nation or even an Intolerance.
But man, they're fun.
But they're a lot of fun. Yeah. And they're movies that you haven't seen that I'm glad you are seeing.
Yeah, me too.
Okay, that's it for Bringing Up Baby. Goodbye, Howard Hawks. You're a good one. But we will soon see Grant and Hepburn, as we've said before, in Philadelphia Story.
What is our next podcast? I can't remember what our next podcast is.
Oh, let me look my notes here.
Oh, man, what was it again? Let's start with a...
Oh, right. Stagecoach.
Stagecoach! Who could forget?
That is the next one. It's John Ford, it's John Wayne, their first movie on the list.
And our first Western on the list.
Our first Western, and that's next week.
In the meantime, for more from Brian and me, please visit our website, top100project.com. And you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com, and follow us on Twitter, @top100project. And cut.